Hey folks, and welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. I want to start off by thanking everybody here, you, the audience, for making the Istanbul event with Google come true. It's a Sunday, it's a couple of days after the event, and it was absolutely fantastic. We've done it 3 times in a row, and every time it's just a lot of work, but when it happens, when you see the faces, when you see the people, it's I don't know. Gratitude might be the right word that I'm searching for. And nevertheless, it wouldn't be possible without you, the audience. So I just want to thank you for that. And talking about you, the audience, we have a pretty awesome podcast coming your way. So two guests on this podcast, Goldman Sachs, a top investment bank in the world, not just game industry, in the world, and Lightspeed, a top venture capital in the world, also one of the best venture capital firms. Now, in this podcast, we are going to talk about the market, the layoffs, venture capital, publisher models, AI, Web3, and what will happen in the next 2 years. And I think these two guests, these two who represent these two powerful companies, are they are the money behind our industry. And if you want to know the truth, according to the saying, you have to follow the money. So I hope you enjoy this podcast and the insights that the two gentlemen, Moritz Beyer-Lenz from Lightspeed and Hemal Thacker from Goldman Sachs are sharing. If you're watching this on YouTube, Hemal's video disappears toward the end. Don't worry about it. He's still online. He will still be talking, but you won't be seeing him. And then last one, public service announcement, GDC is around the corner. At the time of this publishing, it is a week from now, a little bit over the week. There's at least 4 different Deconstructor of Fun events happening. Most of them have been oversubscribed, but if you want to still sign up for them, there's a sign up link in our newsletter, and you can also to learn more about the events through our Slack group and grant access from there. Sorry for being a little bit tired. Events are fun, but also really draining. And I hope you enjoy this podcast, and I hope to see you at the upcoming GDC. So, ladies and gentlemen, Hemal Thacker and Moritz Beyer-Lenz. So it is a Saturday. It is about midday now in the West Coast, and it's an evening here in Helsinki. And before we start, I'll have the pleasure of introducing both Hemal and Moritz, both returning guests on the podcast. So for those who haven't listened to the previous episodes, Hemal Thacker is the Managing Director, Global Head of Gaming and Interactive Entertainment Investment Banking at Goldman Sachs. That's a long title. So what he actually has done out of all the, you know, exhausting list of deals and investments, I'll just raise few. So helping Microsoft to acquire Activision, selling Rovio, Zynga, ZeniMax, Scopely, just out of the few, helping Tencent to invest into Ubisoft, Lego to invest into Epic, as well as IPOs such as Roblox, Unity, and IronSource. So if you want to watch the full exhaustive list, you can find Hemal Thacker on LinkedIn. It's quite the best of the best list. So welcome back to the podcast.
Appreciate it.
And then we have Moritz, an always guest, an always person that we refer to, the investor extraordinaire, Moritz Beyer-Lenz, partner at Lightspeed, a global leading venture capital firm, more than $30 billion in asset under management, and over 200 exits across United States, Europe, and Asia, because exits are the ones that matter. Right, Moritz?
They don't hurt.
Yeah, especially if you're a venture capital firm. Correct. So enough of me promoting you, but let's talk about something that I'm truly thankful for the two of you joining, and that is what is going on in the market, because I doubt there are many people who know more than the two of you. So truly a pleasure to have you both here.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward system to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com. This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fund really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing a full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fund, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fund are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
And I wanted to start with something very simple and something that we can spend a full hour on, but let's try not to. And that is the market. And more specifically, where are we in the market today? I'm curious as like what is happening on the macroeconomic side. So of course, the inflation has been seemingly going down, and the interest rates are not at least going more up as it seems, and perhaps even going down. We can see that the stock market is at an all-time high if we look at the US, and on the other hand, if we look at China, it's not looking that great. And I'm just curious, like Hemal, starting with you, is like, what are you seeing in the market, and more specifically, how are these macro factors affecting consumer behavior?
Sure. And thanks for having me, by the way. Always good to be on a podcast with Moritz, who we used to work together in the old days. So look, I think, you know, if I rewind back a year and a half ago or so when I was last on this podcast, maybe even 2 years ago, things were in a very different spot, right? I think we had seen a big growth pull forward on the back of COVID, and, you know, things were hot. Candidly, in gaming and consumer internet, everything along those lines. And since then, last 18 months, call it, we've had a very strong bout of inflation across the global economy, candidly. Central banks have obviously increased interest rates as a result. And, you know, I think we've had about a year, maybe a year and a half-ish of essentially pressure on the consumer, which has translated into weaker demand, right, in gaming in particular, especially on the content side, but even on things like hardware and other areas. And, you know, whilst inflation has been reducing and is lower than it was, you know, it doesn't solve the fact that everything's more expensive and people's wages haven't really caught up to that yet. So as a result, I think what you've seen from consumer behavior, particularly with respect to games, but also broadly, is, you know, people are being more disciplined with their wallet, right? They're spending overall a little bit less, but the distribution of their spend has changed a lot and is focusing on their core franchises. And gaming is not one big community. There's many different sub-communities and genres that people like, but they've rebased to their core franchises. And also, you know, a lot of focus on, you know, spending money on new games where they know they're going to get great value. And that tends to lend itself to classics, you know, games that may have released 4 or 5 years ago, but were 10 out of 10s. And, you know, that means it's a tricky environment if you're a developer trying to push new pipeline into the market, in this market. We've also had an amazing bout of supply in 2023. I think from a gamer's perspective, you know, what better year to be a gamer with all the fantastic content that came out? But, you know, people have to choose where they stand. And I think, I do think that some of that is coming towards a heed where, for, you know, better or worse, but unfortunately, there have been a lot of layoffs on the back of this reduction in demand in the industry. And it feels like that's continuing. Hopefully that comes to an end soon. But there, you know, it's essentially a rebasing. Demand has come down, supply needs to contract, you know, accordingly. And, you know, on the other end of it, we may end up with, whilst a smaller industry, perhaps a healthier one, into 2025, where things look a little bit clearer and, you know, a bit more normal, perhaps.
Yeah, those are really good points. Actually, we were going through a few different data sets from Newzoo and the other one from Data AI, one looking at PC and console, the other one looking more from a mobile perspective. And what we saw on PC and console is actually, despite the launches of so many great games, there were clear blockbusters, like from Diablos to Zeldas and so forth, the actual console market did not grow. And it seems like the spending just shifted from games as a service model and from the subscription services more to premiums, because as you said, they were prioritizing those franchises that everybody was playing at that point. And on mobile, we kind of saw similar type of change of spending, where people were at least seemingly spending less on in-app purchases, yet they were continuing to spend on apps, and especially the utility and social media and streaming apps were the ones that were kind of holding on and being inelastic in terms of demand. So definitely that's a very valid point. Moritz, do you have anything to add on this topic, or do you
want to
move on? Because we have about 10 topics.
That's right. I'll try and segue here too. But I think it's, you know, easy to, when you spend all your time and attention in the gaming industry, to kind of see this as a gaming topic or gaming problem. I think, you know, what we see in gaming, both on the consumer spending side, but also on the investment side, you know, VC activity and funding, it's by and large a tale of, I would say, consumer technology trends. And it's probably 2/3 driven by the interest environment and then by tapering COVID tailwinds. I think what specifically gets added for gaming on top is also tapering metaverse and Web3 tailwinds from 21 and 22. So they exacerbated slightly. I think, you know, if you want to use layoffs also as another metric here, it's probably around double the exposure, with like 6% of the industry affected over the last 2 years versus 3% in tech more broadly. But the two are tightly interlocked, as Hemel laid out. So we can talk about macro trends. We can talk about gaming specific trends. I'm sure you wanted to talk about layoffs too.
Yeah. Before we jump into the layoffs, of course, that's a topic we need to cover. I wanted to kind of ask, like, something that Hemel pointed out is specifically that the consumer's spending, consumers are more choosing where to spend, and they're choosing the sort of a safe franchises, if you will. How is that seen in the investment behavior? Like what is the type of investment horizon that you're looking at, and how do you interpret this data? Is it just that you believe that in the future we will go back to users being more exploratory as the disposable income increases, or like how does this affect your investment behavior or investment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a trap to kind of look at the year, the past year, the future year for us. Like most of our funds are 10-year funds with typically two optional 1-year extensions. And so really the question is, what's the exit environment in 6 to 8 years from today, which is hard to predict. And so you kind of come back to what I think are still very strong fundamentals and sector tailwinds. There's a lot of generational tailwinds in gaming, right? Every generation now grows up to be gamers. That wasn't the case a couple of years ago, while also gamers who have been gamers continue to be gamers. Gaming is not necessarily for the young. It's for people who grew up with gaming. And at this point, that's pretty much everyone. And then you have technological tailwinds, including AI, And so I think it's really, even with, I think, a hiccup or a bit of a roadblock in 23, 24, it's really hard for me not to be excited about gaming in the next 5 to 10 years in interactive media.
I'll just dig deeper a little bit on the VC climate before the sad layoffs topic. A lot of the sort of a public messaging that you see on LinkedIn and others is that VCs are not investing right now, and they don't know what to invest in, and kind of like they should be investing right now, but they're not doing deals, and sort of a negative sentiment around the venture capital. How has this environment changed the investment thesis? Like, what are you seeing overall in the VC market? Like, of course, your fund is a very unique, and it's very big. It has a long-term horizon, but there's a lot of gaming specific funds that are not, you know, part of $30 billion assets under management. So what are you seeing on the VC front? And is it, when do you see a change when more money is going to start flowing in again into gaming?
I'll give you my candid take, and maybe it's a little bit different from most of the things that people read out there, but I genuinely think the biggest problem in VC and gaming VC specifically is that somehow for the last 3-4 years, we've held gaming investments somewhat of a different standard. Again, like drawing on the consumer analogy, these are startups where they're very much subject to a power law. Like, to return funds, you need not just companies that do well, but you need generational companies, not nice to haves. You need to have invested in startups that upend incumbents. And, you know, really being in the business of trying to build high quality funds with consistent performance now over 20 years, and I've shown you our receipts prior, right? We're not trying to be the most active. We're not trying to run an incubator spray and pray approach. I think for us, it's per partner making 2 to 3 investments per year and then fully dedicating ourselves to those companies with the expectation that there's a small chance for them to become a $5 billion plus company. And frankly speaking, if you look at studios, platforms, tech investments over the last 4 years, personally, at least, I find it very hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel for a lot of them to make the thesis how this becomes a $5 billion company. And obviously, there's a lot of great games that are being built, and I'm happy to see them get funded. But the sheer reality is for someone like us, you know, trying to return a $7 billion fund, and you know, our LPs are expecting 3 to 4x on that fund. So let's say 4x, needing to return $28 billion to LPs, at 5 to 10% ownership at exit, we need to aggregate around $250 to $500 billion in exit volume. So for me to be part of a $1 billion company or even a $5 billion company, that's good, but it doesn't materially turn the needle. And so every time I look at an investment, I hold it to that standard. And then I guess the beauty for us is also not having those sector specific funds. But having large vehicles separated by stage, but that span across geos, that span across sectors, we're basically holding each investment to that global and cross-sector standard. Is this a company where we see a clearly articulated thesis for this to become a $5, $10 billion plus company? If no, it's probably not worth the investment at the time. And obviously, most of these will still be wrong. But I don't think that's the bar to which gaming investments and particularly studio investments have been held. And I think that the vast majority of studio investments are actually a better fit for the traditional publisher model and maybe never lend themselves to venture investing.
You know, I think that for better or worse in 2020, 2021, 2019, et cetera, that there was this secular focus, right, on gaming being this portion of the entertainment space, which was just secularly taking share from other areas. You had huge demographic tailwinds, etc. And so a lot of capital, you know, came into the space and the bar was lowered as a result. But, you know, the gaming industry always had a relatively healthy system in place, right, for investing in new projects, and it was the publisher model or strategics, et cetera. We're sort of reverting to that a little bit, or at least the balance therein. I do think that, you know, to your point of consumer behavior, I think what this last 12 months, 18 months has certainly shown is that gaming is not immune to, you know, recessionary impacts or recession-like impacts. The consumer, are rational economists, right, when it boils down to it, and they're very smart with their own wallet. And I think as a result, there's a lot of companies now, and I think you see it across the board, and Candidly would be my counsel to most companies out there who are creating content, is, you know, the game this year is going to be who can drive a sustainable business model to survive through to 25 and 26 when the content slate is going to be lighter and the ability to break through the noise if you're a new game is going to be better. There are companies who will manage that. There'll be companies that won't. And candidly, the industry, you know, will have to get to a place of a little bit more rationality in order to get back to equilibrium, right, on sustainability. And that may take a little bit of time, but I do think that that's necessary. And if I'm a new studio, or if I'm an existing studio for that matter, you know, I'm very mindful of putting dollars to work on new pipeline. And perhaps it's short-termist thinking, probably is to some degree, but it comes from, you know, at the end of the day, there's an inclination to ensure that you're generating returns or you're doing it in a sustainable way. And I think we're in a market where maybe the pendulum swings too far before it comes back to normal, right, on some of these things. And that's the nature of capital markets and what companies do as in response to them. But I do think as a result, we're probably entering, you know, a year of austerity before we enter a year where people think, gee, maybe I don't have a strong enough pipeline. Maybe I should be doing something about that. And it kind of swings a little bit the other way. So we got a bit of both.
Mm. And Himal, talking about IPO, since that is something that you're very familiar with, IPO market is you know, largely considered dead, especially for gaming companies. Can you a little bit explain why it is seen that way now and when it might revive again later? Like, what are those factors in the business or in the macroeconomics that have to change to get the IPOs flowing again?
I mean, Kirk, I would actually disagree with that statement personally, the idea that the IPO is dead. I don't think that's true. I think that the IPO market is actually open. I mean, we've been printing IPOs. We did a few last quarter. We just had a few across various portions of the economy, and we just had a healthcare one this week. So the IPO market fundamentally are investors in a what has been a relatively stable valuation environment and financing environment for about 12 months now. Is the capital there? Yes. You know, is stability there? Yes. And therefore, valuation is rebased, sure. But people are, you know, people who have the need to get liquidity or, you know, solve employee pressures in that way or just raise capital for other purposes. The market is there for that. The quality bar is high, right? So you tend to see it for companies who are already, you know, profitable at scale, have clear growth levers, perhaps aren't too driven by secular tailwinds or headwinds, but have, you know, increasing market share or whatever they're doing. So there's some industries that fare better for it now. And certainly in tech, media, telecom, we're seeing it as well. So I think we'll see a bunch of that probably through mid-year. After that, I think people may, you know, have eyes on the elections that are coming towards the end of the year. So you may get a bit of a pause, but the market's certainly there. It's not in its full force in the way that it was back in 2020, 2021, but it's recovering. Gaming IPOs specifically, I think that's actually more of a function of, are there that many gaming companies that are IPO-able and IPO-ready, right? Certainly there are companies that could go down that path. Whether it's the right time or not, I think is more of a business-related question than it is a market-related question. My personal view is, you know, I could see more of it from gaming companies in 25, maybe 26. But that's not to do with the market. That's to do with which companies are out there who might consider it and when's the right time for them based on their pipelines and things that they're doing and other, you know, initiatives that they have in place and where it sits on the priority list.
Do you think that that the larger investors, you know, the those who invest in public companies, the retirement funds, et cetera, institutional investors, do you think they are, or you would know, but are they burnt on games a little bit because we had so many IPOs that didn't go that well? I mean, the market did shift pretty significantly with a lot of different industries, but gaming specifically, we saw a lot of gaming companies, not only esports, but a lot of different gaming companies that are really not doing nearly as well as when they IPO just a few years ago.
Yes and no, because, you know, most public market investors don't just hold gaming stocks, right? They hold many different sectors. When you actually look at the cohort of companies that went public in 2020 and 2021, whilst yes, the vast majority have come off, you know, there are other sectors, software, internet, et cetera, which have come off more. So, you know, I think it's a relative game rather than an absolute one. And to Morris's point earlier, it's candidly because of the macro and interest rate environment, right? Cost of capital has gone up, valuations have come down. Whether we like it or not, you know, every single one of us is a macro investor. And so I think, you know, I think funds are smart enough on that front, to know the difference. Where I think there is a lot of discernment right now is between high quality companies and lower quality ones. You know, there are some companies who responded to this macro shift in a very constructive way for shareholders, whether it be driving efficiency, you know, focusing in on key growth areas, in slimming down in other areas, which, you know, has an impact on the other stakeholders, which is employees and these type of things, right? But there are other companies who haven't done that and perhaps have those issues or perhaps some structural issues or inefficiencies in their system, and they've suffered more. That's kind of where you see, you know, when the tide comes out, you start to see who's kind of got their act together and who doesn't. I think that's going to be the focus of 24 now. Right. As people do this slow, you know, execution work, basically, to get their companies in tip top shape for the future growth period.
Hey, game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Xsolla's got your back with Xsolla PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Xsolla PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Xsolla's PayStation in action? Visit xsolla.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
So let's talk about efficiency. So part of, you know, driving efficiency is unfortunately layoffs. And we've saw those coming in 2022 for general tech companies. And in we made the prediction that in 23, the layoffs will hit the gaming market. And unfortunately, they did pretty hard and seem to continue and probably switching even now from layoffs to closures during the 2024. Can you talk a little bit? So let's start with Moritz. Can I get perhaps your view on the startups and how they are approaching layoffs? Because, you know, we in 21, in 22, everybody was just focused to hiring, and it was incredibly difficult to hire people. All kinds of leeways, all kinds of packages were given. You could work out of Bali if you want, as long as you work for this company. And suddenly it's shifted where employers in the driving seat, you got the investors who are telling them that we need more efficiency, productivity. 24 is going to be challenging, 25 might be difficult, but we need you to be in a fighting shape in 26. So that's what I'm hearing from the outlook. But please, Moritz, as an investor and a board member in many of these companies, how are you viewing this?
Yeah, I mean, as sad as it is, obviously, there is a bit of an opportunity window for some of our startups that are well capitalized. And, you know, that have taken, even in these most recent rounds of layoffs from this year, taking in talent to augment their roster. Even when I started at Lightspeed early 2023, for the rounds I've done since on the studio side, Believer and Gardens, I think we've raised large rounds, but these teams have also taken above average dilution in those rounds. So there was already a focus on really making sure that companies are well funded for what looked already like the onset of a bit of a winter and a tough time to come. But also in other cases, with InWorld, for example, building an additional war chest for acquisition opportunities and, you know, coming out on the right side of this unfortunate dynamic. I think, you know, a lot of these trends, whether that's layoffs, whether that's investors reconsidering their strategies and maybe also quantity of investments, overall, like if you want to summarize it under one theme, it's really just return to quality. Even if you see where layoffs have been made, and it's not across the board, it's often in kind of like ancillary initiatives where maybe companies grew a little ahead of themselves at the kind of like double or triple tailwinds of 21 and 22. Like that's where cuts are being made right now. And I think from an investor perspective, like this return to capital, return to quality also just comes down to, you know, what I just mentioned, like holding every single investment to that high standard and asking yourself whether that can really be a company that changes the face of gaming. Because I think for venture capitalists, that is where the bar should be. And to me, doing like one or two studios per year always felt right. People can look this up. That's what I've been doing pretty much since 2020. Half of these studios are on track or have already raised $100 million or more. So clearly there is something to that approach. Theorycraft, RateBase, InWorld, Methodical, Believer, Gardens, super interesting projects in incubation right now. Which is, by the way, that would be my only criticism on an otherwise excellent article from Matt Ball this week, that we haven't seen the best VC studios come out yet. There are very, very few that have launched, right? But like most of them, I think, were funded in this 2020-21 era. And so let's give the best VC-backed studios also the benefit of the doubt before we draw conclusions around whether this works as a venture capital category. Because my firm belief is still absolutely yes. But you have to be selective, as everyone is being right now in many different ways.
Yeah. So it has gotten easier for venture-backed studios to hire top talent, not only, well, because of the layoffs in two ways, just because there's human, there's people talent available. And secondly, probably because there's sort of a picture that working at one of those big publishers is a safe place has eroded. And actually, if you are a venture-backed and well-funded studio, that is probably the safer place to be at during a market downturn. Would you put it that way?
I think, I don't know if there's safety in general. I think you want to make sure, in general, you want to make sure you surround yourself with extraordinary people. I think that's probably a good rule of thumb. Whether you find those in a corporate environment or whether you find those in a startup, I think both can be very viable options. And people have different preferences and also risk profiles. So I wouldn't give a blanket recommendation for startup life either.
Got it. Hemal, looking at the layoffs from more public company perspective, like why is it that so many companies that are profitable are choosing to do layoffs? Is it purely to focus? Like what kind of signal does it give to shareholders and why that sort of a signal is important to do through layoffs?
Yeah, and look, it's tricky, right? Because this is a very sad thing, right? And it's human, and it impacts people's lives, to be honest. But I think if you're putting your rational investor hat on, and you're looking at the forces that have come at play, a lot of this is somewhat, you know, it's a symptom of the overall macroeconomic climate. Gaming industry is not alone in this, right? Look at every internet company, most software companies, pretty much every other sector of this, of the world. And I think it's worth seeing forests from trees on that, which is, okay, we went through a period where, you know, we had a lot of stimulus coming to the economy on the back of COVID. It gave people a lot of disposable income and it drove a lot of demand. When you drive a lot of demand, you want to meet that with supply. And gaming's not immune to that. So people want more content, people hired a lot, and then you service that content. And the byproduct of that was 2023, which was one of the best years ever for gaming content. Now, you flip that the other way, where the stimulus stops, the world opens up again, it has the hangover from COVID, and the consumer starts spending all the money that they got and drives a massive inflation cycle, everyone's poorer. And demand comes down and supply as a result has to contract in order for these companies to drive kind of just health of companies beyond not, you know, just shareholder value. Is that a byproduct of a lower growth environment? Absolutely. Is it a decision that these companies want to take? No. But is it a company decision that they have to take in order to candidly survive for, you know, through the next iteration of all of this? Yes. And that applies, you know, to big companies, small companies, mid-sized companies. And here's the kicker. If one large company doesn't do it, the investment dollars flow to the ones that do. And so, you know, it's actually pretty difficult, if you think about it, for companies not to make these type of decisions, even if they don't want to. And so you see it from large public, large private. You have to readjust to a new market dynamic, a new market size. Now, does that mean that if I'm laid off somewhere that I don't have a great skill set that could be applied? I think some of Morris's points hold true, right? There's plenty of companies that are in that investment cycle and you find roles that you can to them. But I do think there's a portion of, you know, the job market in this space, which will have to rebase, i.e. move to other industries because there won't be room. And that is a very tricky, harsh reality. Typically, these things don't play out as quickly as they have. We haven't seen an environment where interest rates have moved as quickly as they have for many, many decades. And so it's a very unusual type of swing. But in our case, it's happened in basically under 2 years.
Yeah, since the 70s. And it's interesting to look back at the those inflation rates and kind of comparing what happened then so that it doesn't sort of happen again. Because back then, if I remember correctly, as the inflation started going down due to the high rise of interest rates, the Fed pulled down the interest rates and the inflation went even higher, so that they had to come up with new set of interest rates that pushed them even higher. And it was almost like a lost decade. So when people are kind of expecting that the interest rates are going to go back down soon, I kind of wonder that they won't do that mistake again, and they would rather hold the interest rates for a longer time at a higher pace. And through that, we'll have this environment for a longer period of time, and it's not going to be over in soon.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering, you know, the 70s was 50 years ago. Most people who were in the games industry weren't working then. The games industry was barely around then anyway. It didn't even exist really, right? So, you know, people don't have that context. And why would they, right? And I think when it comes to interest rates, you know, I think that our house view at least is they will decrease, but not as much as, you know, people hope, back down to zero, and certainly not on a time frame that's quick. So,
yeah. It's just my problem of studying economics. So
but that's the context that people should have, or try and keep in their minds as solace, that it's some of these things, it's not personal, really. I think it's a function of markets.
Yeah. So even when it starts, that's what I'm thinking, even when it starts looking good, the central banks will still hold the interest rates longer, just in case they won't do the double whammy and lose a decade. Anyway, let's talk about something more fun, which is the AI. And this has been, of course, the focus of all the investments, whether we're talking about public or private. And it seems like, so I'll give the context of me trying to set up a talk at the upcoming Istanbul Gaming Summit. Which actually Hemal has attended, unlike Mr. Moritz. Anyways, March 7th. Anyways, and one of the talk that we're going to have this year is with Google DeepMind, as well as with an investor in a studio. And it was surprisingly difficult to find an investor and a studio to talk about AI, and specifically the use of AI in games. Like, there were a lot of different cases, but they were more of the stories than they were an actual winning scenario. So it brought this sort of a question in my head, is like, we can all agree that AI is going to be powerful in the future, but it seems like it's more of a story right now, unless you're a hardware company where it actually drives your sale, because everybody is preparing. And we maybe don't know how the story will play out. This is the kind of like the thing that I'm thinking in my head. Moritz, maybe since you've done one of the, if not the biggest AI investment in a company that does AI in games, like, how do you see this?
I must say I'm a little surprised to hear that. I think the vast majority of our game studios and their engineering staff by now has embraced copilots for development quite heavily. Most are using generative 2D and 3D, at least in prototyping, or, you know, anything pre-production. Some are leveraging AI in production. So maybe you're just asking the wrong people. I think in terms of value creation, it's really hard to see how it wouldn't change the face of gaming. I do genuinely think this is a platform shift. And I know it's a super lame and cliche thing for VCs to say, so I'll have to be extra convinced to kind of like double down on statements like this here. But I think this is really akin to the introduction of the internet, or the introduction of the mobile phone, or, you know, introduction of cloud. And the value is already demonstrated. It's different from Web3, for example, where the vast majority of the value is still to be proven out and to be demonstrated, right? Like, it has, I think it's hard to say which has the higher ceiling of the two, but one's working right now, and one is doing valuable things today. What I will say I'm a little bit surprised about is that, and this was kind of like one of the core theses of an article that we pushed out last year, which I think was on the front page of Google for AI gaming, or gaming AI for the better part of the year. Usually in platform shifts like these, the companies that really knock it out of the park are the ones that create completely new, previously impossible experiences. Yet, if you look at what most AI companies are focused on, it's trying to help devs build things better, faster, cheaper. It's like marginal improvements. It's kind of like trying to port, you know, existing workflows to a somewhat new paradigm instead of really starting from scratch and building for that new paradigm from the ground up. And so, you know, InWorld is a great example for that, right? Like it's really, we're really good at creating these photorealistic environments. I mean, Unreal Engine 5 and I'm sure 6 is amazing. But, you know, creating a photorealistic Manhattan is kind of lame and boring when you can't also fill it with 1 or 2 million New Yorkers with dreams and hopes and aspirations and background stories and means of interactions, maybe if no one else is even locked in. So intelligent NPCs, agentic simulations, emergent behavior and runtime, like that is something truly and fundamentally new. And somehow, so far at least, we've settled for the fact that that's just not something that happens in video games, even in open world video games like GTA. And so I'm personally very focused on those type of companies. The beauty also of Lightspeed is we have investors, our senior partners that have invested throughout those previous platform shifts that were actually there when the internet started to become a thing or when mobile started to become a thing. And so there are certain patterns and lessons learned from that, which is why we're really focused on trying to find the ones that that embrace paradigm shifts front and center. We've, I think, invested now about $1 billion across 70 companies and across sectors on what we would consider AI first companies, not just over the last year or two, but really over the last 10 years. But of course, very increased activity over the last 2 to 3 years. I think generative AI has really pushed AI as a class forward. It has its own limitations too, especially on the quality of reasoning. Like, will we see new AI models pop out and pop off over the next year or two? Very likely, right? There are already some early innings on that. And so it's as we see, it's kind of like get the foundation models, get the application layer right when so much is changing so fast. It's very hard. And obviously it draws a lot of, you know, external criticism to see VCs chase these opportunities, which, by the way, typically involve like hundreds to hundreds hours of diligence, at least speaking for us. But it's still incredibly hard to get them right. But I think what's almost certain, a certain strategy for doom is to just ignore it. And I think the one thing that we can't afford to do is miss a platform shift, which also drives a lot of the current investment behavior in the space.
I didn't mean it in the sense that is AI going to have an impact or no. It just felt weird since it's been so much talked about that so few of the studios would be willing to talk about it. And I feel like there's an element in it that not all studios feel comfortable talking about the usage of AI. And in those conversations, I've understood that there's sort of a worry of a backlash internally as well as from the players, which was interesting perspective that I wouldn't have assumed.
It ties in with general insecurity, you know, about the future of the industry, about job security too, right? Obviously, from the developer perspective, from an artist perspective, there are very valid concerns about the importance of one's existing skills that in some cases might not just get augmented, but could indeed get replaced.
But I assume like for any startup that is, you know, investable by the prestige funds, you have to be pretty pretty on board with the usage of AI at this point. Would that be a correct
assumption? I come back to my previous statement, right? Like if the bar is to be a generational company that upends the incumbents, I think your chances are already stacked against you from the onset. So you'll have to get creative in terms of technological levers, and AI is just a very strong technological lever that you can pull, because the incumbents are playing not to lose. So we need to invest in startups who are playing to win. And that involves bold choices. And I think that involves embracing AI head on. I do genuinely believe that. And, you know, AI finds its way in almost every pitch we see today. But then you can find out in one conversation or two or three or four or five, like how deep and how thoughtful that thesis actually looks like. I want unfair secrets. I want novel beliefs that if unique beliefs that if true can be profound. Just telling me that you're leveraging AI in your development process, I think we're like a year past that.
Mm. And Himal, from your perspective, like everything we talked about in terms of AI for startups and for venture capital, how do you see it coming in from, you know, these monumental companies? Like, what is their view on AI? I mean, we know what Microsoft and others are, you know, doing with the AI, but your perspective on AI.
By the
way. Look, I think with big companies and mid-sized companies, to be honest, both public and private, it's worth remembering that they fundamentally are a different scale, have different stakeholders, or more of them, right, than startups. So I think to assume that they are not doing things in AI is a little bit dangerous, right? I think that it just because it's understated, and there's a lot of, you know, under promise over deliver mentality that flows through that, for good reason, by the way, because, you know, large and mid-sized companies can't afford to have a situation where they overdo it on that front, and people overestimate the timeline in which, you know, they could deliver something that incorporates all that technology and changes the game for them. But certainly my personal observation has been that most players are doing a lot internally on this space. They do have a lot of stakeholders to convince, which Mars touched on, but they're doing a lot on this space. They just don't talk about it as much. And they do that on purpose. And so I think and by the way, you know, if you were a big tech company and you had some, you know, very innovative project going on, you see it from those kind of companies too. They don't talk about stuff until it's closer to becoming in fruition. I think everyone in the industry, from my perspective, is trying to do something with this, whether it's productivity related, whether it's creation perspective. Some are more vocal than others, and some are deeper in it than others. That much is true. There's players who are playing on the surface level. There are players who are playing very deep and just not talking about it. But I agree, it's a platform shift. But a lot of these players are very incentivized to explore this because it has application today, and it can drive margin improvement and returns today, and it could drive growth tomorrow. And the fruits of some of this, you know, don't forget the AI train, if you will, you know, whilst it's been building up for a long time, the true focus on it has only been a year, right? Games take a lot longer than that to develop typically. And so we may see the fruits of some of these efforts come through over the next 2, 3, 4 years, where you get your killer app, if you will, and some game that really showcases something completely different. And that may well be, you know, companies in Moritz's cohort, or it could be from large or mid-sized private and public players. We don't really know, right? It then depends on the consumer after that. But I wouldn't underestimate it. I think that people are focused. Whether it fits the narrative they want to put out there right now is a different question.
Mm. Moritz, anything to
I just think there's also, again, there's like lessons learned from previous, you know, not just platform shifts, but I think let's call it like major innovations, whether that's from a technological perspective or from a business model perspective in gaming, right? I feel like it kind of like usually takes 2-3 years for folks to figure something out, right? Like in-game monetization, right? Started as pay to win. And then it ended up being all about cosmetics, which I don't think people were on that train in year zero or one. And so you experiment your way into those patterns that work. And as I touched on earlier, as Hemal laid out as well, like that ability to experiment and that drive to experiment is always a little bit stronger on the challenger side, on the startup side, than it is for the incumbent. That's the classic innovator's dilemma, which creates a bit of a beauty of creative destruction. If that weren't the case, you know, and if all value would always drive to the incumbents in all scenarios, then we wouldn't have to do our job, right? But that's kind of like the beauty of the industry, that there are different risk profiles and in some cases, different rewards.
Yeah. And in the end, when we're talking about AI, would it be can you describe it as doing more with less? Like, is that in the end what AI allows?
I think that'd be sad to reduce it to that. I think that's almost a category that I don't want to see more of. I think that's the reality, I think, for most studios today as customers of AI. But as builders for AI solutions in interactive media, I don't want to see the developer tools that shave off 5% margin. I want to see the things that help people build stuff that would simply be impossible and unimaginable without generative AI.
That's a good way to put it. So let's talk about something that let's talk about Web3 actually. So this has been sort of a confusing element in the games industry, at least for me. So in 2020, it kind of became the thing, and suddenly Web3 gaming was at the forefront of everything. And I remember in I think it was 2021, I was talking to investors about possible Series A. And you would get laughed out of the room if you were doing something else than Web3. It was like you were pitching them a board game if it didn't have a crypto or tokenomics. And then in 2022, and especially in 2023, we saw first the slowdown of the whole market, and then basically companies pivoting away from Web3 during 23. Yet again, today I see the Bitcoin price is pretty high. I think my crypto wallet is for the first time on the plus, which I did not expect. Actually, somebody hinted me, and I opened up like first time my crypto.com in a year. I was like, oh wow, this is interesting. So where are we with Web3? Is it tied to the cryptocurrencies? At least I see still companies pivoting away from Web3. So maybe Morris, you want to lead with this?
First of all, I think even in 2020 or 21, I think 21 was kind of like really when it took off. I think even then there was a bifurcation between kind of like believers and skeptics. And then also there has been a lot of, I think, tourist inflow into gaming purely based on the Web3 strategy that has tapered off. But all of that aside, I think it's an interesting premise to ensure digital identity and digital ownership, right? There's nothing wrong with that. I think the two major issues of Web3 gaming, at least until now, is I think it's twofold. One is we haven't seen the right talent pursue those opportunities by and large. And I think, you know, a lot of teams building, these are all Web3 gaming specific comments. A lot of teams building were not trained game designers, producers, and I think didn't fully appreciate the complexity of creating social interactive media, which is still media and about engagement and retention first and foremost, before it becomes a topic of how to distribute the value, which I would kind of like put Web3 more in the value distribution and value creation category. It's not 100% correct, but kind of like the goal was lost a little bit, which is building an amazing game first and foremost, before you before you strategize around all the gimmicks around it. And so those games had just not been built. There are a few Web3 projects that look very exciting right now. So I think this year we could see the first great Web3 game. And there's no argument to be made why Web3 games can't be built well. But that was one issue. And then the other issue, which brings me back to my, you know, example of business model innovation with free to play, it's just really hard to get business model shifts right in the first instance. And I think, you know, there were some obvious rug pulls and scams, but a lot of these economies that ended up falling apart were really built with the intention to get it right. And there was a lot of time and energy spent into figuring it out. And again, that it just takes 2-3 years to get these things right. And so maybe we'll now see it in year two or in year three, we see these economies work. Where I still am a little bit skeptical is I'm not sure for gaming specifically how valuable to the player the digital integrity or identity or ownership beyond the custodial reach of like a company or a nation really matters. Like going back to my own gamer days from 20 years ago, I was logging into my account and that felt like my stuff. I was selling it, you know, back then on eBay in the form of untaxed child labor, which, you know, can that be improved? Was there more friction than necessary? Yes, but that doesn't necessitate Web3 to figure that part out. So do I really think that my items were not well kept and well intended and guarded by Blizzard? No, I think it's in their best interest too that I have my stuff and I have freedom in using my stuff. So I think the jury is out on that. There's a lot more exciting use cases for Web3, financial rails, you know, and I think that's also where, for example, Goldman focuses a lot versus interactive media applications. So by the way, I think blockchain transactions have been creeping up even through the trough. If you just look at usage of the blockchain, it's been up and to the right without much of a downturn, you know? So this is mostly a price downturn. It's not an activity downturn. I'm not an expert on Web3, but that's kind of like my high level take on Web3 gaming and a little bit beyond.
Hemal, would you agree that this it's a time span question and not more like first and foremost?
I think it's a time span, but also a TAM question. You know, I think to Moritz's point, the attributes of Web3 and what it can deliver in terms of customer or consumer value proposition are going to be valuable to some people, right? Who perhaps want that ability to have high priced items. They want to trade them. They want to buy, they want to sell them. There's almost a bit of a real money aspect to that, right? And there's others who don't care, right? I'll give you an analogy. I listen to Spotify and I honestly don't care if the music is, you know, mine or not, as long as I can listen to it. So, and I think, you know, that jury's still out there on what the size of the TAM around the first piece really is, right? And so then the default has to be, it's got to be a great game if you want to make it mass market, which is Moritz's earlier point. And then I do think I agree with Moritz on there's an interesting layer of this, which is once you have a digital economy, and that's what a game ultimately is, especially more life service oriented ones, and people spend all of their time and they collect things there. You know, there is an interesting concept of, well, that could underpin a broader economic transactions, right? And then, you know, your coins start being valuable as currency in other areas. But, you know, the dollar bill works too, right? So I think there's that. I think we're yet to see where that really goes off. And part of it is because there isn't really a massive game today, sustainable one at least, that is, you know, core to Web3, which has taken over the imagination mind share of various people. So until we get there, I think we won't see it. is there a lot of promising content that's being developed that could release this year, next year, etc.? Yes. But, you know, then it's got to go about the same modes of growing that normal games do. User acquisition, the network effects that come with that. These things take time. But certainly, if there's going to be a game that's underpinned by AI and does something quite different, I could see that being a game that's underpinned by Web3 and does something quite different. The time will tell.
And especially in the economic downturn, if you are able to create a game that is good, so it garners a big user base, and if users can actually earn by interacting with that game, that would be a pretty powerful marketing proposition for a game during the time when it's very difficult to market new games. So yes, I think the point that you made before, the pendulum swinging always to the a little bit too far from where it was, could apply here as well. All right, so a couple of more questions.
There's one secular point that I think is pretty interesting, is because of what's going on in the crypto markets with respect to Bitcoin prices, etc. You have to remember that, you know, Bitcoin is essentially the reserve currency of the crypto ecosystem. So as that goes up, everybody else is wealthier in normal dollar terms, right? And most of these titles that are out there that are Web3 oriented have some sort of token underpinning them. So their sheer ability to put more capital to work, to grow, to develop, to scale their teams, to accelerate their progress has gone up because Bitcoin has gone up. And I think as a result, you know, there will be people who reignite the bandwagon there. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I think that, but that's due to sort of bigger factors, right? Which is the crypto economy as a whole, not just the gaming piece, but the gaming piece will certainly benefit from it.
Yeah. So moving on to the couple of last questions. So kind of like the future of overall this integrated model, like given a lot of things that we've discussed, is there still a chance for individual content creators to make it on their own anymore? Or is the game now fully rigged for publisher and a platform model? So Hemal, maybe we'll start with you since you were discussing this quite deeply with the VC versus publisher approach.
Yeah, look, I think the short answer is no, right? I think look at Lethal Company, look at Power World and as a group, but examples of companies that, or people, just individuals, right? BattleBit was another one, where things can come up out of nowhere. Now, in all of those cases, or in many of those cases, this wasn't the first project that those people tried, right? And maybe they were in it for 7, 8, 9 years before they really got something out of it, but something eventually broke through. Do I think that the barriers to doing so at this exact moment in time are very high? Yes, right? Where the crowded field of content plus the amount of dollars that have been in the ecosystem, both from the big end and also the startup side of things, it's not easy. Will that get better in 25, 26 when the calendar gets a little bit slimmer? Yes. You know, do I think it's easier than ever, you know, from just a pure, remember there was a time when you wouldn't self-publish on Steam, right? Now you can, but you need the supply to be, you know, normal, right? To kind of push through that and for the development expenses, to create something that's good enough, you know, to be reasonable, perhaps you manage to, you know, have lightning in a bottle and do something on the cheap, but generally speaking, trickier. And the go-to-market to acquire users and players has to be efficient as well, and that's got more expensive too. So I think it's harder than it was. There's more noise to break through than there was. Does it mean it's not doable? No, because all the tools are out there, right? Anyone can get an engine license and start developing. But I do think that there's more games now than there've ever been. And so it's more competitive than it's ever been for what was a market that did grow and now is in a slight contraction phase. And the consumer is more vigilant with their dollar spend.
And Moritz, from your perspective, like when you're funding these teams and you know, the funding that you get from Lightspeed is not a joke. How do you evaluate that this team can break through in the future environment to become, you know, 10 billion, 20 billion dollar company. Like, what are those elements that, you're looking at?
I mean, I think I'm known for looking at teams that have previously demonstrated their success as really typically lead designers, lead producers of franchises that gross like $250-500 million a year. Does having done that before guarantee they'll do it again? Typically, no. But again, you know, our work factors in a certain miss rate as well. I think one important point is like when I think of funding these studios with the projects that we go after, I actually think that on average, or at least median of those studios that I've funded since 2020, they probably raised or will raise $100 million or more. They're not really out there building games because I think that's not even good enough. Even with a success story, that's not good enough to build a multi-billion dollar company. You really have to build a platform or like a social network of sort. And so I think it's really hard to do when you don't work with at least $100 million. And that's a lot of money, right? But these need to be projects that are built with the audacity to do something novel and creatively beautiful, but also from the get-go have to be set up for life ops operation with a content pipeline of typically, you know, a year plus at time of launch. And so you look at these outliers, you know, and we all know those surprise hits over the last 2-3 years. They're also really hard to sustain and really turn into something bigger when it wasn't part of a 4-5 year mission that this particular one would be your one big bold shot. And so if you then reduce it to what are really the projects and incubation that are of that caliber with those teams, with that funding, the air gets actually pretty thin. And like, by funding them and by picking them, you automatically lift them into a class of, I don't know, 10, 20 projects or something like that, that are out there right now that actually compete head to head with AAA. And that's kind of been my strategy for studio investing, at least. And so we'll see if it works, right? I want to be intellectually honest that the feedback loop is not closed on this strategy. But if you look at the early ones and the ones that will come out 2024, 2025, I mean, frankly, I remain optimistic on this approach.
Yeah. You made an interesting point about these small, like, surprise hits that have come out seemingly out of nowhere and how they don't have the sustainability because it has been a somewhat surprise and because the team usually hasn't done live operations before and is not equipped to do that. But I think another point that is great and challenging at the same time is that they hit the jackpot, and that is very they get a lot of money in a very short amount of time, a small indie studio of like 4 people. And so the incentive to like, hey, let's now put everything back into this and grow into this massive operations and do this and that is kind of maybe not always there. And you're like, you know what? We're fine. It seems like we're doing just fine. You know, everybody got $5 million and, you know, they're getting, you know, a million a month, and it's all fine, and they're not looking to grow. So I'm kind of, I think the success is a little bit of a bad thing as
well. It's not a bad thing at all. I think it's awesome. And like, ultimately the player wins in all of this. Right. And like, kudos to those who create these outlier successes, but it's a little bit, not all of those lend themselves, again, coming back to the initial point, it doesn't all lend themselves to the venture category, right? And they're different ideas of where the goalpost is and what constitutes success. And I think those are great examples for studios that either bootstrap or use traditional publisher funding to, you know, make $100 million, which is a lot of money.
My point is actually that the player loses, because if they would have, or if they would sell that asset to another studio that is able to invest more and to add more longevity to that game, let's say Valheim as an example, I think the players would gain more. And now the player actually loses because the team is not incentivized to build that. But I think that's a little bit of a different conversation, just something.
As of right now, I'd say the players are fine. Lots of great games. games are way too cheap. If you believe Strauss Zelnick.
Yes.
I agree with him, by the way, on that point.
Well, he's not the only one. Yeah.
Me too.
Well, he's not the only one who's saying that. All right. So last question is, thinking about 24 and 25, like, what do you, I don't know if predict is the wrong word, but what do you foresee is going to happen? What do you feel is going to happen in the market? Is there going to be a, you know, is the downturn going to continue and then it's going to be an upswing? And I would like to ask you, like, from a perspective of founders, because most of our, well, the number one title of our of people in our audience is a founder or a co-founder, and the third one is a chief executive officer. So maybe putting yourself in those shoes, like, what would you do? So, Hemal, if we start with you, 24, 25.
Yeah, and look, this is, there's no one size fits all, but I would say I would use the first half of 24, knowing that there's a relatively busy content slate, to drive whatever productivity and efficiencies that I have left to do. I would probably assess really carefully where I'm going to strike the balance between focusing on existing franchises and not giving up on the new things that I really do believe in and are going to have legs, you know, in 25, 26, because balance is important. I would then, you know, consider, what do I actually need to put out this year to maintain cash flows, growth, et cetera? What can wait for a better consumer day? There are some great games that have come out which just candidly just couldn't break through the noise. If you can wait for a better market to put them into, then why not? But that's a debate to have, and management, you know, has to think about that with respect to investor expectations too. I would think carefully about if I've got plenty of, you know, I think about balance sheet management pretty carefully. There's some companies that are very well capitalized and perhaps too well capitalized. Should they be thinking about capital return? There are other companies that are undercapitalized and perhaps have to manage cash burn and those type of things during this year, in which case it's sort of, what do I really need to run the business? And should I, you know, if I'm doing okay, or I released a product that did okay, how do I set myself up so I can play for another day, right? Drive cash flow, strike a publisher deal, push forward and play for the next phase. How you think about your cap structure management is pretty important in that context, especially if you're on the smaller end. You know, how you think about any financing that you do in this environment, what valuation that you put on it, you know, are you being too aggressive today and you price yourself out as a founder out of a liquidation because of a liquidation preference in the future. Thinking really carefully about budget and business plan management, those type of things will be in focus for me. Where I'd be optimistic and very sort of looking more macro. Look, I mentioned this before in a bunch of these over time. I continue to believe that the single biggest opportunity outside of AI in our space, from a pure donors perspective, is advertising. And I believe this since 2018. And it hasn't fully come to fruition yet. And arguably, there's hundreds of billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines waiting for a form factor to really nail how advertising gets into this space. You see some of the majors starting to really do some innovative stuff on that front, including some of the UGC players. And I think that to me, along with AI, are probably the two biggest areas of just massive TAM expansion for the games industry, which is needed. That, and then also the lowering barriers to entry for HD gaming. Specifically, you see a lot of very innovative things going on. Look at what the TV OEMs are doing by providing controllers with their televisions and having their, you know, their OSs tied up to, you know, cloud streaming services. It will take a while. It's a slow ramp, but it really does lower the barriers to entry for folks who want to get into HD gaming. That's interesting. And then where I'd be a bit more cautious is on the go forward on mobile with respect to how some of those dynamics in that space play out and the viability of that space as a standalone monetization place, or, you know, is it something that becomes a funnel, right, for other platforms, which certainly many mobile companies are moving in that direction. So those will probably be the areas I'll be focused on in 24, 25. There'll be some of that, you know, out of that decision tree that leads companies to say, I'm doing great. There's others who say, I need some changes. There's others who say, I can't do this myself. I need to pair up with somebody, which obviously drives my business. There's others who say, you know, I'm doing fantastic, but I want to do even more and I can't do that by myself. It also drives my business, my M&A. And there's others who may say, you know, I really want to make sure I set this business up for the long haul. And, you know, perhaps 25, 26 is a good time for listings to give employees liquidity or upside in the story or, you know, the company capital to go and do things, in which case you'll see some of that too. I'll pause there, but I think that's sort of what I would have in my mind.
Yeah, if I do my full summary, it's basically... focus on austerity for 24, but don't forget to invest into your future for 25 and really wait for those moments. And as you said, there are games like Alan Wake that you know came from Remedy, which is like 2-3 kilometers away from where I live, got like raving reviews. And I don't think the sales were really on par with the reviews and the rewards that the game got. And if they would have launched perhaps in a different time, I think they, you know, would have done significantly better, at least for the launch week. So, definitely a very good advice if you can, you know, if you can manage to launch later. Mr. Moritz?
Well, you asked about what founders should do, and I think, by the way, most of them have already, you know, cut down to the reality that is 23 or was 23 and is 24 in terms of how they're managing cash and how they're thinking about fundraising. So maybe as it relates to founders that are coming to market in gaming and specifically in game studios, you know, I don't really care so much what template people use. Like sometimes there's a little bit too much, I think, talk and philosophizing around like what the best structure is and what all the topics you need to hit. Like, I think, as I've said now, I think twice on this podcast, we just need to remember where the bar is in VC and consumer VC specifically. So my advice for a founder would be explain to me very clearly how this is a company that will upend incumbents and has a path to become a multi-billion dollar generational company that usually hinges on some kind of unfair secret or unique insight that if correct is profound. I want clarity of thinking, communication, like strong mental maps of how things should be done, extreme sense of urgency. And Ray Dalio has this thing about founders. He says he wants to see dissatisfaction with the status quo. Nothing ever feels good enough. And that gap is both a tragedy and a constant source of motivation. So I think that's the kind of founder that is working on the right thing in the right way in 2024. That has merit to be venture funded. And just to end on a positive note, because I feel like this podcast was pretty gloomy by and large, there's still very strong fundamentals and tailwinds in gaming. And interactive social media experiences are not going anywhere. Yeah. So just to be clear also, consumer spending in gaming is actually slightly up in 2023. Mobile gaming spend is kind of like recovering on a path back to pre-IDFA levels. So I think just because suddenly gaming is, let's call it flat, everyone's freaking out, right? Because we've been spoiled with continuous growth since 1997. I think it's okay to have like one flat year. But there's nothing wrong with the generational and technological tailwinds that are still present in this industry. There's vertical applications that are finding their way out of gaming, born in gaming, into other sectors, because it's just a domain that pushes the boundaries on 3D technology and really human experiences in many ways. And so I think just for all of us, and you know, as founders, as builders, as executives, as bankers, as capital allocators, as podcast hosts who are, you know, leaders in this industry in some form or another, I think it's also important as stewards of the industry to just remain optimistic. Because I think if we're not excited about the future, then what are we all building toward?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, it's very easy to listen to this podcast and just, think of it that way. I think it's worth remembering that what we've been talking about is the here and now. I think gaming is still fundamentally the best growing and the most profitable part of media entertainment, which is a huge industry in and of itself. It has a lot of secular tailwinds. It has a lot of dollars and engagement flowing into the ecosystem. It's got the demographics. It's got geographics too. And I think it's got very, very well-functioning business models. It maybe needs to, get into shape. But other than that, so do I, think. But other than that, I think we'll be okay. But we're just going to ride out a year or so.
Yeah. I think this was a very useful podcast because, we talked a lot about the realities. But nevertheless, even despite being so doom and gloom and grim, at the same time, the notion that the market is going to pick up in 25 and 26 and don't stop investing on the next products in your pipeline, like those constantly existed. So I think there's valuable information for founders for right now. And even on Web3, we were positive. The overall census in the market right now is gloomy. And I think that the founders should be aware of what is expected of them and what is a good business practice for them to survive through these couple of years so that they can be on the upswing when that eventually starts. And we've seen similar types of dips and then following bull markets in every single industry. So I don't think this is any different from that on. So I think we can all agree that we're positive about the market, but also realist in terms of what is expected right now. And thank you for really talking from the point of investors and, it's even hard to say what Goldman Sachs is. Goldman Sachs is like everything. It's, you touched upon on all the points, but from the point of large companies, like why certain things are happening, not only from the industry perspective, but also from the market perspective and investor perspective and why we're seeing layoffs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a important context for people to hear. So huge thanks for educating me and a few thousand other people who are listening to this. So I think everybody can get in, knows how to get in touch with you through LinkedIn, and I will put your LinkedIn information in the description below. And once again, thank you. And Hemal, hopefully I see you in Istanbul. And Moritz, I'm not going to even ask. Anyways, I hope you have a great day. And thank you again for coming on the podcast and illuminating everybody in the industry. So on that note, thanks everybody for listening. Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.